Polly paused outside the door to pull her socks up, retucked the end of one under her belt as an anchor, and hurried down to the inn's kitchens. A look told her all she wanted to know. Food hygiene here consisted of making a half-hearted effort not to gob in the stew. "I want onions, salt, pepper," she began. The maid, who was stirring the soot-black pot on the soot-black stove, glanced up, realised she'd been addressed by a man, and hastily pushed her damp hair out of her eyes. "It's stew, sir," she announced. "I don't want any, I just want the stuff," said Polly. "For the officer," she added. The kitchen maid pointed a soot-blackened thumb to a nearby door and gave Polly what she probably thought was a saucy grin. "I'm sure you can have anything that takes your fancy, sir," she said. Polly glanced at the couple of shelves that had been dignified by the name of pantry and grabbed a couple of large onions, one in each hand. "May I?" she said. "Oh, sir," giggled the maid, "I do hope you're not one of them coarse soldiers who take advantage of a helpless maiden, sir."
No, I'm not one of them," said Polly.
"Oh." This didn't seem to be the right answer. The maid put her head on one side.
"Have you had much to do with young women, sir?" she asked.
Yes, quite a lot," said Polly.
Lots, really."
"Really?" The maid drew closer. She smelled mostly of sweat, tinged with soot. Polly raised the onions as a kind of barrier.
"I'm sure there's things you'd like to learn," the maid purred.
"I'm sure there's something you wouldn't," said Polly, and turned and ran. As she made it out into the cold night air, a plaintive voice behind her called out, "I'm off at 8 o'clock!" 10 minutes later, Corporal Scallet was impressed. Polly got the feeling this did not happen often. Shufti had wedged an old breastplate beside the fire, had hammered some slabs of horse meat until they were tender, dipped them in some flour, and was frying them. The sliced onion sizzled next to them.
"I always just boil 'em," said Scallet, watching him with interest.
"You just lose all the flavour if you do that," said Shufti.
"Hey, lad, the stuff I've ate, you wouldn't want to taste it."
"Saute things first, especially the onions," Shufti went on. "Improves the flavour. Anyway, when you boil, you ought to boil slow. That's what my mam always says. Roast fast, boil slow, okay. This isn't bad meat for horse. Shame to boil it anyway."
"Amazing," said Scallet. "We could have done with you in Ibblestarn. The Sarge was a good man, but a bit, you know, tough in the leg."
"A marinade would probably have helped," said Shufti
absently, flipping a slice of meat with a broken sword. He turned to Polly.
"Was there any more stuff in the larder, Oz? I can make up some stock for tomorrow if we can—"
"I'm not going in that kitchen again," said Polly.
"Ah, that'll be Roundheels Molly," said Corporal Scallet, looking up and grinning. "She sent many a lad on his way rejoicing."
He dipped a ladle in the boiling scubbo pot next to the pan. Disintegrated grey meat seethed in a few inches of water.
"That'll do for the Rupert," he said, and picked up a stained bowl.
"Well, he did say he wanted to eat what the men eat," said Polly.
"Oh, that kind of officer," said Scallet uncharitably. "Yeah, some young ones try that stuff if they've been reading the wrong books. Some of 'em try to be friends, the bastards."
He spat expertly between the two pans.
"Wait till he tries what the men eat."
"But if we're having steak and onions—"
"No thanks to the likes of him," said the corporal, ladling the slurry into the bowl. "The Slovenian troops get 1 pound of beef and 1 pound of flour a day minimum, plus fat pork or butter and 1/2 pound of peas. A pint of molasses sometimes, too. We get stale horse bread and what we scrounge. He'll have scubbo and like it."
"No fresh vegetables, no fruit," said Shufti. "That's a very binding diet, Corp."
"Yeah, well, once battle commences, I reckon you'll find constipation's the last thing in your mind," said Scallet.
He reached up, pushed some rags aside, and pulled down a dusty bottle from a shelf.
"Rupert's not having none of this, neither," he said. "Got it off of the baggage of the last officer that went through, but I'll share it with you, 'cause you's good lads."
He casually knocked the top of the bottle off against the edge of the chimney.
"It's only sherry, but it'll make you drunk."
"Thanks, Corp,"
said Shufti, and took the bottle. He sloshed a lot of it over the sizzling meat.
"Hey, that's good drink you're wasting,"
said Scallet, making a grab for it.
"No, it'll spice up the meat, a fair treat,"
said Shufti, trying to hang on to the bottle.
"It'll sugar."
Half the liquid had gone on the fire as the two hands fought for it. But that wasn't what had felt like a small steel rod shooting through Polly's head. She looked around at the rest of the squad, who didn't appear to have— Maledict winked at her and made a tiny gesture with his head toward the other end of the room, and strolled in that direction. Polly followed. Maledict always found something to lounge against. He relaxed in the shadows, looked up at the rafters, and said, "Now, I say a man who knows how to cook is no less of a man for that. But a man who says sugar when he swears? Have you ever heard a man say that? You haven't, I can tell." "So, it was you who gave me the socks," thought Polly. "You know about me, I can tell you do, but do you know about Lofty? Maybe Shufti was very politely brought up." But one look at Maledict's knowing smile made her decide not to try that road. Besides, the moment you looked at Shufti with the idea that maybe he was a girl, you saw that he was. No man would say sugar. "Three girls now, and I'm pretty sure about Lofty, too," said Maledict. "What are you going to do about them?" she said.
"Do? Why should I do anything about anyone?" said Maledict. "I'm a vampire officially pretending not to be one, right? I'm the last person who'll say anyone has to play the hand they were dealt. So good luck to him, say I. But you might like to take him aside later on and have a word with him. You know, man to man."
Polly nodded. Was there a knowingness to that comment?
"I'd better go and take the Lieutenant Iscobo," she said. "And, blast it, I forgot about his laundry."
"Oh, I wouldn't worry about that, old chap," said Maledict, and flashed a little smile. "The way things are going around here, Igor's probably a washerwoman in disguise."
Polly did the laundry in the end. She wasn't sure that she'd be able to dodge Molly a second time, and there wasn't that much of it. Afterwards, she hung it in front of the fire, which was roaring. The horse had been surprisingly good, but not as surprising as Blouse's reaction to the scubbo. He had sat there in his evening dress uniform, wearing special clothes just to sit down and eat all by yourself as a new one on Polly, and had yummed it up and sent her back with the bowl for more. The meat had been boiled white, and there was scum on the top. The squad wondered what kind of a life an officer could have led that inclined him to like Scubbo.
"Don't know much about him," said Scallet upon questioning. "He's been here 2 weeks, fretting to get to the war. Brought a whole cartload of books with him, I heard. Looks like a typical Rupert to me. They were all behind the door when the chins were handed out. A sergeant who went through said he's not really a soldier at all, just some wonk from headquarters that's good at sums."
"Oh, great," said Maledict, who was brewing his coffee by the fire. The little engine gurgled and hissed. "I don't think he can see very well without his glasses," said Polly, "but he's very, polite."
"Not been a Rupert for long, then," said Scallet. "They're more, hey there, you, damn your eyes, faw, faw, faw. I seen your sergeant before, though, old Jackram. Been everywhere he has. Everyone knows old Jackram. He was with us in the snow up at Ibblestarn."
"How many people did he eat?" said Maledict, to general laughter. The dinner had been good, and there had still been enough sherry for a glass each.
"Let's just say I heard he didn't come down much thinner than he went up," said Scallet.
"And Corporal Strappy?" said Polly.
"Never seen him before either," said Scallet. "Cross-grained little bugger. Political, I'd say. Why's he gone and left you here? Got a nice cushy bed in Ian, has he?"
I hope he's not going to be our sergeant," said Wazza.
"Him? Why?" said Scallet.
Polly volunteered the events earlier in the evening. To her surprise, Scallet laughed.
"They're trying to get rid of the old bugger again, are they?" he said. "That's a laugh. Bless you, it'll take more than a bunch of Gawains and Rodneys to leave a Jackram out of his own army. Why, he's been court-martialed twice. He got off both times. And you know he once saved General Frock's life? He's been everywhere, got the goods on everyone, knows more strings than me, and I know a good few, mark my words. If he wants to march for you tomorrow, he will, and no skinny little Rupert'll get in his way."
"So what was a man like that doing as a recruiting officer?" said Maledict sharply.
"'Cause he got his leg cut open in Slovenia and bit the sawbones who tried to look at it when the wound went bad, clever dick," retorted Scallet. "Cleaned it out hisself with maggots and honey, and then drank a pint of brandy and sewed himself up and lay on his bed with a fever for a week. But the general got him, I heard, came and visited him while he was too weak, and told him he was going on the drumming for a year and no argument. Not even Frock hisself would hand him his papers, not after Jackram had carried him on his back for 14 miles through enemy lines."
The door swung open, and Sergeant Jackram walked in, tucking his hands into his belt.
"Don't bother to salute, lads," he said as they turned guiltily. "Evening three parts. Nice to see nearly all of you again, you artful old god-dodger. Where's Corporal Strappy?"
"Haven't seen him all evening, Sarge," said Maledict.
"Didn't he come in here with you?"
"No, Sarge, we thought he was with you."
Not a muscle moved on Jackram's face.
"I see," he said. "Well, you heard the lieutenant. The boat leaves at midnight. We shall be well down the Kinnick by Wednesday's dawn. Get a few hours' sleep if you can. Tomorrow's going to be a long day, if you're lucky."
And with that, he turned and went out again. Wind howled outside, and was cut off when the door shut. "We'll be well down the Kinnick," Polly noted. "Well done, three parts."
"Missing a corporal," said Scallet. "Now there's a thing. Usually it's a recruit that goes AWOL. Well, you heard the sergeant, boys. Time to wash up and turn in."
There was a washroom and latrine, in a rough-and-ready fashion. Polly found a moment when she and Shufti were in it alone. She'd racked her brains about how best to raise the subject, but as it turned out, just a look was all it took.
"It was when I volunteered to do the supper, wasn't it?"
Shufti mumbled, staring into the stone sink which had moths growing in it.
"That was a clue, yes," said Polly.
"A lot of men cook, you know," said Shufti hotly.
"Yes, but not soldiers, and not enthusiastically," said Polly. "They don't do marinades."
"Have you told anybody?"
mumbled Shufti, red in the face.
"No," said Polly, which was, after all, strictly true. "Look, you were good. You had me fooled right up until sugar."
"Yes, yes, I know," Shufti whispered. "I can do the belching and the walking stupidly, and even the nose-picking, but I wasn't brought up to swear like you men."
"Us men," thought Polly. "Oh, boy."
"We're the coarse and licentious soldiery. I'm afraid it's shit or bust," she said.
Why are you doing this?" Shufti stared into the dank stone sink, as if strange green slime was really interesting, and mumbled something.
"Sorry, what was that?" said Polly.
"Going to find me husband,"
said Shufti, only a little bit louder.
"Oh dear, how long have you been married?" said Polly, without thinking.
"Not married yet,"
said Shufti, in a voice as tall as an ant. Polly glanced down at the plumpness of Shufti.
"Oh dear. Oh dear." She tried to sound reasonable.
"Don't you think that you should—" "Don't you tell me to go home," said Shufti, rounding on her. "There's nothing for me back home except disgrace. I'm not going home. I'm going to the war and I'm going to find him. No one's going to tell me not to, Ozzer. No one. This has happened before, anyway, and it ended right. There's a song about it and everything."
"Oh, that," said Polly. "Yes, I know.
Folk singers should be shot.
What I was going to say was that you might find this helps the disguise."
She produced a soft cylinder of woolly socks from her pack and wordlessly handed it over. It was a dangerous thing to do, she knew, but now she was feeling a kind of responsibility to those whose sudden strange fancy hadn't been followed by a plan. On the way back to her palliasse, she caught sight of Wazza hanging his little picture of the Duchess on a handy hook in the crumbling wall above his mattress. He looked around furtively, failed to spot Polly in the shadows of the doorway, and bobbed a very quick curtsy to the picture. A curtsy, not a bow. Polly frowned. Four. She was barely surprised now, and she had one pair of clean socks left. This was soon going to be a barefoot army. Polly could tell time by the fire. You got a feel for how long a fire burned, and the logs on this one were grey with ash over the glow beneath. It was gone 11, she decided. By the sound of it, no one was getting any sleep. She'd got up after an hour or two of lying on the crackling straw mattress, staring at darkness and listening to things move about underneath her. She'd have stayed on it for longer, but something in the straw seemed to want to push her leg out of the way. Besides, she didn't have any dry blankets. There were blankets in the barracks, but three parts had advised against them on account of them carrying, as he put it, the itch. The corporal had left a candle alight. Polly had read Paul's letter again, and took another look at the piece of printed paper rescued from the muddy road. The words were fractured, and she wasn't sure about any of them. But she didn't like the sound of any of them. Invage had a particularly unpleasant ring to it. And then there was the third piece of paper. She couldn't help that. It had been a complete accident. She'd done Blouse's laundry, and of course you went through the pockets before you washed things, because anyone who'd ever tried to unroll a soggy, bleached sausage that had once been a banknote never wanted to do it twice. And there had been this folded piece of paper. Admittedly, she needn't have unfolded it, and, having unfolded it, needn't have read it. But there are some things that you just do. It was a letter. Presumably, Blouse had shoved it in a pocket and forgot about it when he'd changed his shirt. She didn't need to read it again, but by candlelight, she did.
"My dearest Emmeline, fame and fortune await. After only 8 years as a second lieutenant, I have now been promoted and am to have a command. Of course, this will mean that there'll be no officer left in the Adjutant General's Blankets, Bedding and Horse Fodder Department, but I've explained my new filing system to Corporal Dreb, and I believe he is sound. You know, I cannot go into matters of detail, but I believe this will be a very exciting prospect, and I am anxious to be at the foe. I am bold enough to hope that the name of Blouse will go down in military history. In the meantime, I am brushing up my sword drill, and it is definitely all coming back to me. Of course, the promotion brings with it no less than 1 shilling extra per diem, plus 3 pence fodder allowance. To this end, I have purchased a charger from Mr. Honest Jack Slacker, a most entertaining gentleman, although I fear that his description of my steed's prowess may have been prone to some exaggeration. Nevertheless, I am moving up at last, and if fate smiles on me, this will hurry forward the day when I can." And that was it, fortunately. After some thought, Polly went and carefully damped the letter, then dried it quickly over the remains of the fire and slipped it into the pocket of the washed shirt. Blouse might scold her for not removing it before washing, but she doubted it. A blanket counter with a new filing system. An ensign for 8 years, in a war where promotion could be rather fast. A man who put quotes around any word or phrase he thought of as even slightly racy. Brushing up on his sword drill. And so near-sighted, he'd bought a horse from Jack Slacker, who went around all the horse fair's bargain bins and sold winded old screws that dropped a leg before you got home. Our leader. They were losing the war. Everyone knew that, but nobody would say it. It was as if they felt that if the words weren't said out loud, then it wasn't really happening. They were losing the war, and this squad, untrained and untried, fighting in dead men's boots, could only help them lose it faster. Half of them were girls. And because of some bloody stupid song, Shufti was wandering off into a war to look for the father of her child, and that was a desperate errand for a girl, even in peacetime. And Lofty was trailing after her boy, which would probably be romantic right up until 5 minutes into a battle, and she... well, yes, she'd heard the song too. So what? Paul was her brother. She'd always kept an eye on him, even when he was small. Mother was always busy. Everyone was always busy at the Duchess, so Polly had become a big sister to a brother 15 months older than she. She'd taught him to blow his nose, taught him how to form letters, went and found him when crueler boys had got him lost in the woods. Running after Paul was a duty that had become a habit. And then, well, it wasn't the only reason. When her father died, the Duchess would be lost to her side of the family if there was no male to inherit. That was the law, plain and simple. Nugganatic law said that men could inherit the things of men, such as land, buildings, money, and all domestic animals except cats. Women could inherit the things of women, which were mostly small items of personal jewellery and spinning wheels and cats passed from mothers to daughters. They certainly couldn't inherit a large, famous tavern. So the Duchess would go to Paul if he was alive, or, if he was dead, it was allowable for it to go to Polly's husband if she was married. And since Polly saw no prospect of that, she needed a brother. Paul could happily carry barrels around for the rest of his life. She would run the Duchess. But if she was left alone, a woman with no man, then at best all she'd get would be maybe the chance to go on living there while the deeds went to Cousin Vloppo, who was a drunkard. Of course, all that wasn't the reason. Certainly not. But it was a reason all the same. The reason was simply Paul. She'd always found him and brought him home. She looked at the shako in her hands. There had been helmets, but since they all had arrow holes or gaping rips in them, the squad had wordlessly gone for the softer hats. You'd die anyway, and at least you wouldn't have a headache. The shako's badge showed the regimental symbol of a flaming cheese. Maybe one day she'd find out why. Polly put it on, picked up her pack and a small bag of laundry, and stepped out into the night. The moon was gone. The clouds had come back. She was drenched by the time she'd crossed the square. The rain was coming horizontally. She shoved open the inn door and saw, by the light of one guttering candle, chaos. Clothing was strewn across the flagstones. Cupboards were hanging open. Jackram was coming down the stairs, cutlass in one hand, lantern in the other.
"Oh, it's you, Perks," he said. "They've cleaned out the place and buggered off, even Molly. I heard them go. Pushing a cart by the sound of it. What are you doing here?"
"Batman, Sarge," said Polly, shaking water off her hat.
"Oh, yeah, right. Go and wake him up, then. He's snoring like a sawmill. I hope to hell the boat's still there."
"Why'd they bug Scarper, Sarge?" said Polly, and thought, "Sugar. If it comes to it, I don't swear either." But the sergeant didn't appear to notice. He gave her what is known as an old-fashioned look. This one had dinosaurs in it.
"Got wind of something, I don't doubt," he said. "Of course, we're winning the war, you know," he said.
"Ah. Oh, and we're not going to be invaded at all, I expect," said Polly, with equally exaggerated care.
"Quite right. I detest those treacherous devils who'd have us believe that a vast army is about to sweep right across the country any day now," said Jackram.
No sign of Corporal Strappy, Sarge?"
"No, but I haven't turned over every stone yet."
"Shh!" Polly froze and strained to listen. There were hoofbeats getting louder as they approached, and changing from thuds into the ringing sound of horseshoes on cobbles.
"Cavalry patrol," Jackram whispered, putting the lantern down on the bar. "Six or seven horses."
"Ours?"
"I bleed in doubt it."
The clattering slowed and came to a stop outside.
"Keep 'em talking,"
said Jackram, reaching down and sliding the door's bolt across. He turned and headed toward the rear of the inn.
"What? What about?" whispered Polly.
"Sarge?" Jackram had vanished. Polly heard murmuring outside the door, followed by a couple of sharp knocks. She threw off her jacket. She wrenched the shako off her head and tossed it behind the bar. Now she wasn't a soldier, at least. And as the door was shaken against the bolt, she saw something white lying in the debris. It was a terrible temptation. The door burst open at the second blow, but the soldiers didn't immediately enter. Lying under the bar, struggling to put the petticoat on over rolled-up trousers, Polly tried to make sense of the sounds. As far as she could tell from the rustles and thuds, anyone waiting inside the doorway with ambush in mind would have been briefly and terminally sorry. She tried to count the invaders. It sounded as though there were at least three. In the tense silence, the sound of a voice speaking in normal tones came as a shock.
"We heard the bolt slide across. That means you're in here somewhere. Make it easy on yourself. We don't want to have to come and find you."
"I don't want you to either," Polly thought. "I'm not a soldier. Go away." Then the next thought was, "What do you mean you're not a soldier? You took the shilling and kissed the picture, didn't you?" And suddenly an arm had reached over the bar and grabbed her. At least she didn't have to act. "Oh, no, please, sir, don't hurt me. I just got frightened, please." But inside there was a certain sockness that felt ashamed and wanted to kick out.
"Ye gods, what are you?"
said the cavalryman, pulling her upright and looking at her as if she was some kind of exhibit.
"Polly, sir, barmaid, sir, only they cleared out and left me."
"Keep the noise down, girl."
Polly nodded. The last thing she needed now was Blouse to run down the stairs with his sabre and fencing for beginners.
"Yes, sir," she squeaked.
"Barmaid, eh? 3 pints of what you'd probably call your finest ale, then."
That, at least, could happen on automatic. She'd seen the mugs under the bar, and the barrels were behind her. The beer was thin and sharp, but probably wouldn't dissolve a penny. The cavalryman watched her closely as she filled the mugs.
"What happened to your hair?" he said.
Polly had been ready for this.
"Oh, sir, they cut it off, sir, because I smiled at a Slovenian trooper, sir."
"Here?"
"In Drock, sir.
It was a town much nearer the border. "And me mam said it was shaming to the family, and I got sent here, sir."
Her hands shook as she put the mugs on the bar, and she was hardly exaggerating. Hardly, but a bit, nevertheless. "You're acting like a girl," she thought. "Keep it up." Now she could take stock of the invaders. They wore dark blue uniforms and big boots and heavy cavalry helmets. One of them was standing by the shuttered windows. The other two were watching her. One had a sergeant's stripes and an expression of deep suspicion. The one who'd grabbed her was a captain.
"This is terrible beer, girl," he said, sniffing the mug.
"Yes, sir, I know, sir," Polly gabbled. "They wouldn't listen to me, sir, and said you have to put a damp sheet over the barrels in this thundery weather, sir, and Molly never cleans the spigot, and—"
"This town's empty, you know that?"
"They all scarpered, sir," said Polly earnestly. "Gonna be an invasion, sir, everyone says. They're frightened of you, sir."
"Except you, eh?"
said the sergeant.
"What's your name, girl who smiles at Slovenian troopers?"
said the captain, smiling.
"Polly, sir," said Polly.
Her questing hand found what it was seeking under the bar. It was the barman's friend. There was always one.
"And are you frightened of me, Polly?"
said the captain. There was a snigger from the soldier by the window. The captain had a well-trimmed moustache that had been waxed to points, and was over 6 feet tall, Polly reckoned. He had a pretty smile, too, which was somehow improved by the scar on his face. A circle of glass covered one eye. Her hand gripped the hidden cudgel.
"No, sir," she said, looking back into one eye and one glass.
What's that glass for, sir?" "It's a monocle," said the captain. "It helps me to see you, for which I am eternally grateful. I always say as if I had two, I'd make a spectacle of myself."
That got a dutiful laugh from the sergeant. Polly looked blank.
"And are you going to tell me where the recruits are?"
said the captain. She forced her expression not to change.
"No?"
The captain smiled. He had good teeth, but there was now no warmth in his eyes.
"You are in no position to be ignorant," he said. "We won't hurt them, I assure you."
There was a scream in the distance.
"Much,"
said the sergeant, with more satisfaction than necessary. There was another yell. The captain nodded to the man by the door, who slipped out. Polly pulled the shako out from under the bar and put it on.
"One of them gave her his cap, did he?"
said the sergeant, and his teeth were nowhere near as good as the officer's.
"Well, I'd like a girl who'll smile at a soldier."
The cudgel hit him alongside the head. It was old Blackthorn, and he went down like a tree. The captain backed away as Polly came out from behind the bar with the club readied again. But he hadn't drawn his sword, and he was laughing.
"Now, girl, if you want—"
He caught her arm as she swung, dragged her toward him in a tight grip, still laughing, and folded up with a gasp as her knee connected with his sock drawer. "Thank you, gummy." As he sagged, she stepped back and brought the cudgel down on his helmet, making it ring. She was shaking. She felt sick. Her stomach was a small, red-hot lump. What else could she have done? Was she supposed to think, "We have met the enemy and he is nice"? Anyway, he wasn't. He was smug. She tugged a sabre from a scabbard and crept out into the night. It was still raining and waist-deep mist was drifting up from the river. Half a dozen or so horses were outside, but not tied up. A trooper was waiting with them. Faintly, against the rustle of the rain, she heard him making soothing noises to comfort one of them. She wished she hadn't heard that. Well, she'd taken the shilling. Polly gripped the cudgel. She'd gone a step when the mist between her and the man fountained up slowly as something rose out of it. The horses shifted uneasily. The man turned, a shadow moved, the man fell.
"Oi!"
whispered Polly. The shadow turned.
"Ozzer, it's me, Maledict," it said. "Sarge sent me to see if you needed help."
"Bloody Jackram left me surrounded by armed men,"
Polly hissed.
"And?"
"Well, I knocked two of them out,"
she said, feeling as she said it that this rather spoiled her case as a victim. "Another one went over the road, though."
"I think we got that one," said Maledict. "Well, I said got. Tonka nearly gutted him. There's a girl with what I'd call unresolved issues."
He turned around.
"Let's see. 7 horses, 7 men. Yep."
"Tonker?" said Polly.
"Oh, yes. Hadn't you spotted her? She went mad when the man charged at Lofty. Now let's have a look at your gentleman, shall we?" said Maledict, heading for the door.
"But Lofty and Tunker," Polly began, running to keep up. "I mean, the way they act, I thought she was his girl. But I thought Tunker—I mean, I know Lofty is a girl—"
Even in the dark, Maledict's teeth gleamed as he smiled.
"The world's certainly unfolding itself for you, eh, Ozer? Every day something new. Cross-dressing now, I see."
"What?"
"You are wearing a petticoat, Ozer," said Maledict,
stepping into the bar. Polly looked down guiltily and started to tug it off, and then thought, "Hang on a moment." The sergeant had managed to pull himself up against the bar where he was being sick. The captain was groaning on the floor.
"Good evening, gentlemen," said the vampire. "Please pay attention. I am a reformed vampire, which is to say, I am a bundle of suppressed instincts held together with spit and coffee. It would be wrong to say that violent, tearing carnage does not come easily to me. It's not tearing your throats out that doesn't come easily to me. Please don't make it any harder."
The sergeant pushed himself away from the bar top and took a muzzy swing at Maledict. Almost absent-mindedly, Maledict leaned away from it and then returned a roundhouse blow that knocked him over.
"The captain looks bad," he said. "What did he try to do to poor little you?"
"Patronize me," said Polly, glaring at Maledict.
"Ah," said the vampire.